Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It's Friday, 30th of October, 2020. Just a few trading sessions away from, we hope will be the result as we go into the Wednesday session next week. We have very interesting market conditions. The market was in a positive attitude during the session yesterday, despite the previous day's terrible sell-off, the worst in months. And then after the close, all of the big earnings reports, of various quality, but the general takeaway was this is not the supportive evidence we were looking for this rally, and we've sold off badly again overnight. We've got the NASDAQ down to a one-month low, and we've got, as I show on slide one, and we've talked about yesterday as well, this 3,200 area in the S&P 500, pretty critical. Technically, all this, it's just so interesting. We're getting to these big technical levels right around the election. And before I get to the earnings and talk to you about those, Peter, just want to point out those headlines, as always, with the U.S. GDP. That makes sense when you're talking about annualizing the growth for 2% annualized growth, 3% annualized growth. But when you have these crazy quarters like we've had, you get a headline that the Q3 GDP was up 33.1%. It's complete nonsense. That's at an annualized pace. And basically, if you look on slide two, you get the right perspective, I think, looking at the year-on-year levels, minus 2.9% year-on-year. We've rebounded from the terrible trough in Q2. But we are still down minus 2.9% year on year. And then relative to trend, the catch up needed is that much greater. But Peter, was it Apple that was really the one, it's the biggest company in the world. It was down 4% in after hours trading. Was that the one that sort of has dragged the broader sentiment down, or is there a pattern across these companies reporting?
Well, I think Apple took the headlines, and that was obviously because it is the biggest company in the world and market value. The iPhone sales were missing, and China declined pretty substantially, almost 30% from a year ago, and they didn't want to provide any guidance for Q4. I think that was a major disappointment. So yeah, the shares were down 4.5% in extended trading. Having said that, it's always interesting because when you go through these earnings releases, they always spin the positive narrative, and Apple obviously didn't focus on what the market focused on. They blurted out with big headlines that they had their record quarter on services, which is right, which you can see on the insert on slide three. The services the services segment is now a $54 billion business and will over time take over and be the most dominant segment, if not on revenue, then at least on the operating profits. It's almost more than half than what they generate on the iPhone, and because the profit margins are better. So, but Apple was to disappoint. But I think the general red thread here, John, before I go through some of the others, is that we also had a lot of tier two earnings below the mega caps here that we're talking about today, and that is that. Expectations, I think, was much higher than what we see in the analyst estimate. So most of companies in the US, I think 85 or 86% of all companies have surprised relative to estimates. And I think that's just to show you that analysts have been quite conservative. They have very hard time, digesting information and how companies have rebounded. I think the market was well ahead of analyst expectations. That's the reason why you're seeing these headache across the board, because also if you look at Amazon, absolute monster quarter on almost every single metric, and their guidance for the holiday season was out of this world, I think, given what we're looking at. But nevertheless, shares were down 2%, and we had a discussion on the internal call, and I think the best guess we have for why shares were down was that actually the Amazon Web Services, while sales is up 29%, as you can see in the insert on slide four, impressive growth rate, and the operating income in the cloud business is up 56%. It is a slower year-on-year growth rate in revenue compared to Google Cloud, which we have on slide five with that insert. The Google Cloud was up almost 50%. So I think a picture is emerging that Microsoft and Google is actually sporting higher growth rates. I think Microsoft was 30% or somewhere between 30 and 40% revenue growth. And And that shows you that Amazon is actually having trouble in Amazon with their Amazon Web Services. And some of the technology experts that we are talking to, most people are actually saying that Google Cloud and Microsoft Cloud is a much better user experience than Amazon. So that might be the story. And Google was up 6%. It was not only the cloud, it was also the YouTube business, which was extremely strong and which is a future growth leg. My final point before I shut up is obviously Facebook. I think Facebook, there was a lot of noise on Twitter last night on regulation of Facebook, because despite a global campaign to stop advertising on Facebook, their advertising business was extremely strong. Nevertheless, shares were down a couple of percent in extended trading. Investors are worried about that monthly active user numbers, which you can see on slide 7. We've put in the CFO's outlook commentary, and they now expect daily and monthly active users in the US and Canada to be flat or even down in Q4. And with the Social Dilemma documentary on Netflix, maybe a lot of people are waking up to what the hell we're actually doing on social media. Could
And
be one of the
what our kids are
explanations.
doing on social media as well.
Exactly. Yeah, good point.
And I was wondering, over to you, Ola, on the what is making Amazon's Q4 outlook so strong? Certainly on the delivery of stuff to your home while you're sitting at home, quarantined and working from home. While it may be good for Amazon, maybe even YouTube, it's not so good for oil. And I guess one of the big drivers for oil weakness here has to be all this renewed lockdowns in Europe and the risk of the COVID. Accelerating again in the US as well.
Absolutely, John, and we've seen that especially yesterday when oil, after a couple of days' weakness, broke out of that range we've been in with for the past couple of months. Brent potentially targeting $35. I got an insert here on slide 10, just highlighting two of these major commodities: gold, which I'll come to, but then on the right-hand side, you've got the Brent crude breaking low, and for now they're just shy of 35 or just below 35 is the potential target on this move. And it is obviously the ongoing rise in coronavirus cases, the lockdowns we're seeing come into effect in Europe this weekend, and the risk that other countries within Europe may join as well, which is driving this. And then also a very rapid rise in new cases in the US just ahead of the election. So all in all, a troubled week for commodities, where the dollar is trading higher and where risky assets such as the S&P is down 6%, which obviously reducing the general level of risk appetite in the market. And you can see on the chart on the table on slide 9 that actually, if you look at gold, which is it's down, but it's obviously not it's one of the better performers. And if you look at gold priced in euros, it's actually flat on the week, and that does obviously tell us that even though we've seen some dollar strength, gold has actually managed to hold up reasonably well, and that is the support coming from the general level of uncertainty. And I think also we saw ECB yesterday talking about something for sure happening in December, fiscal and monetary stimulus will be provided as a result of this continued rise in coronavirus cases, and I think that's why oil, something like gold, is pretty close to finding some support here. And just returning to slide 10, you can see we haven't really broken any key levels. We haven't been tested the September low, and we're still well above the 38.2% retracement of the rally we had between June and August. So gold is it seems like it's stabilizing here and getting ready to move higher. And just on the final note, obviously we've seen quite a strong surge into commodities over the past couple of months by speculators. We're highlighting that in our weekly cut reports, and that obviously also means that when we have these periods of risk adversity, then even though we've got strong fundamentals in various places, especially recently in the grains, all markets are exposed to long liquidation because of the need to reduce exposure. So that's really what's also hurting the market this past week. But some of them will come back quite strongly when we get some normalization. That's it.
All right. Thanks, Ola. And yeah, you mentioned the ECB. There was obviously a meeting yesterday. I wasn't expecting a major market reaction. I think the general sell-off was in anticipation that with the flagging that the ECB will, quote, recalibrate its efforts at the December meeting, is seen as, okay, they're going to come with something big and they're going to round up all the data that's coming in and all their forecasts and get everything hammered out in the meantime. But I really think their existing programs are going to do very little of the heavy lifting needed to move the economy forward in any way or provide stimulus. It really is. And they sort of indicate this themselves indirectly by calling on the EU governments to do fiscal stimulus. And that's what we're going to have to see. And it's going to have to be far, far bigger than what we've seen. It's really going to have to match the types of efforts we're talking about in the US down the road, especially with these renewed lockdowns in Europe. And then across the space as well, the dollar and the yen, just really tracking risk appetite up and down and doing so sort of in sync. They're very, very correlated in the crosses. So dollar yen still looking at that 104 level. But again, if we're seeing yen strength, it seems we always seem to see dollar strength as well. And then something like Aussie dollar, you can see the perspective there. It's been quite resilient in my book, really, relative to what we're seeing in sentiment globally. But arguably, it's very much just tracking something like the MSCI World Index. It also has the Asian exposure, and China seems to have gotten, and other regional powers seem to have gotten on top of the coronavirus. So slide 8, you can see the critical point there at 70. That's the Aussie in black. And then in blue, you have the MSCI index in dollars. And you can see we're also at that key support from September. So it all just looks like it's correlated across the board when we have this type of volatility increase across markets. And then one final point I want to mention is that I put another one of these election countdown pieces out yesterday. And yesterday I focused on voter turnout and how if we get the anticipated surge in voter turnout, this will tend to favor Democrats for obvious reasons, that the youngest voters in particular will vote against Trump by a more than 2-to-1 margin, according to a quite respectable poll I linked to that I think gives a good basic indication. Slide 11, you can see the voter turnout by different age categories over the years since 1980. And you can see that there are some years, what I've called turmoil years in my piece, where the voting participation surges, and it surges most dramatically in the youth vote. So if we get that, let's call it at least a 10-15% turnout increase, but even especially if it's more on the order of 20%, it really does change the odds of this election, and drastically so, and drastically in favor of the Democrats and Joe Biden. And then on the right, I'm just showing you the population pyramid of the US, pointing out that the three largest 5-year cohorts of the population that are the largest are from 20 to 24 up to 30 to 34, with the 25 to 29s that by far the largest portion. These are the people that got out of college and entered a very tough job market and high home prices. So I think it is a key factor. And one final data point on that front, I saw an article this morning discussing Georgia's, the state Georgia's turnout so far in early voting, very strong. And they are anticipating as many as 6 million people in Georgia will vote. That's relative to 4.1 million in 2016. If we're seeing anything on that scale of a voter increase, unless something is motivating the marginal and virtually 100% of Republicans to get out to vote, I imagine this is buttressing my point in the article I put out yesterday. Georgia is a state that went by only a 5% edge to Trump in 2016. So 2.5% more or less switches it to a dead heat there. Peter, you don't have an earnings slide up today, but I remember in the our quick take this morning, you highlighted that we're seeing some of the big oil majors out today in earnings. I guess that's the focus, but obviously the election is the main focus.
I think the election is the main focus, but yeah, we have what I would call an energy day on the table with ExxonMobil and Chevron, the two largest oil majors, integrated oil majors in the U.S. reporting, and we had that news out yesterday that ExxonMobil is finally, coming back to reality. I mean, ExxonMobil was very odd in the sense that they really were clamoring to their dividend payouts to satisfy shareholders. And sort of arguing openly that they would increase their investments despite of the pandemic, and they would not change their overall business, as we have seen many other oil companies definitely scoping out a path in this green transformation to something else going forward, but still relying on the cash flow from the oil gas business, but eventually turning into a different type of energy company, where ExxonMobil has sort of been hammering on the old classic model. And I think there was a sense of reality yesterday. They announced major job cuts onto the global workforce, but not at least 1,900 people, office workers, so not production workers, office workers at their headquarters in Texas. So I think that's a pretty big blow. So it will be interesting to see what they have to say. As all have pointed out, there's a lot of demand uncertainty. The overhang on the on inventory, and but also at the same time the underinvestment. I mean, it's just the whole oil and gas, and we've talked about it, John. 1.5%, I think, is now the oil and gas industry's market cap in the US, and I think even in the global equity market. I mean, and this is the energy that the entire world is running on. So it's I think this is a fascinating story. I can't recommend investors to long-term be overweight this sector, but at one point there must be a massive tactical opportunity in this sector. That's my view at least.
Yeah, especially if once the demand supply equation gets sorted out and all of that lack of capital investment results in a drop in production, assuming that we're not running on magic fuel within the space of 5 years. but that's my perspective there. I agree. It's a staggering thing, that 1.5% figure you mentioned there. All right, on the calendar today, this is minor stuff. We are all looking at that US election and the outcomes there. I will be putting out a bit of a more bits and pieces type of article on the election countdown today. Stay tuned for that on analysis.saxo. But we do have a couple of interesting items, the latest or the first Q3 estimates for Germany and Eurozone on Q3 GDP, as well as some unemployment rate figures. And then the US PCE inflation could trigger a headline or two and get some bond market volatility going in. The US Treasury market has gotten a bit more active at the long end of the curve in particular, and that can be quite influential across markets as well. So watch that one, and stay tuned for next week's unbelievably interesting US election results, and we'll be covering that as closely as we can, of course. For now, have a safe weekend. Be careful out there, and we'll be back next week with the Saxo Market Call. For today, thanks for joining.